that could be a bush or a rock or a bit of dirt on the screen, but that turns out to be another cowboy. How do they know which one to chase? Full cowboys all look the same, but this one is holding a girl, and her thin legs are like wings stuck out of the horse's side. Salome cannot remember ever having seen a horse with wings. She has never seen a cowboy either, but they are not so different from the boys she grew up with. All of them spoke with the same flat voices. All of them looked the same way, the cowboys do. There was no telling any of them apart. Hard, stooped shoulders, mean mouths. "You're lucky that didn't go into my eyes," Mary Margaret says. Setting solution runs down her neck. Salome blots at it with her apron. "What was that psalm you recited in front of the church?"
"Psalm 69.
"How did it go?"
Salome wraps Mary Margaret's head in plastic. The lone cowboy is dead now, shot by the others. His chest is dark with blood that on a color screen would be red. But the color of the blood doesn't matter. Blood is blood, just like dead is dead. Salome can see on a black and white screen as good as on a color.
"Save me, oh God,"
she says in a high school girl voice, careful to smother her thick German accent, to pronounce her word endings and THs.
"For the waters are come into my soul. I sink in deep mire, where there is no standing. I am come into deep waters, where the floods overflow me. I am weary of my crying. My throat is dried. Mine eyes fail while I wait for my God."
"How long does this plastic stay on?"
5 minutes. The plastic stays for 5 minutes. How come you can't remember that?"
"I have always had a poor memory for things. You are the one with the memory. You were always the smart one. You were the one they stood up in front of the church to recite, and then halfway through your hair lifted up off your head. All that bacon fat, and it still wouldn't lie flat. There you were with your hair stuck straight up and shining with grease."
"They that hate me without a cause are more than the hairs of mine head. They that would destroy me, being mine enemies wrongfully, are mighty."
"You always had the good memory," Mary Margaret says.
But Salome isn't listening. The cowboys are weeping over the dead cowboy. It seems there has been a mistake. The girl cries, too, and her blonde hair whips the wind like a flag as a cowboy minister prays over the body. Even on TV, you can see how the Bible speaks the truth. Even a cowboy who looks like all the others will be counted by God and recognized.
"Deliver me out of the mire, and let me not sink. Let me be delivered from them that hate me, and out of the deep waters."
"There's no call to show off." That's what Mama always said, too. "There's nothing worse than a show off," she said. And that afternoon, when we got home from church, she let you have it good. Putting on airs in the house of God, waving your arms like you was acting. We hoped you would marry that Fiedermeier boy, but no one would have you after that. Everyone remembered you waving your arms and your hair shining with that stinky grease. Everybody remembers a show-off, Mary Margaret shouts.
5 minutes is up, Salome says. Go over by the sink. I'll wash it out.
That was no 5 minutes.
5 minutes.
Turn off the TV. If you'd pay some attention to me, you would know when it was 5 minutes, but you've been watching that thing all along. Turn it off! Turn it off! Mary Margaret says.
Salome turns off the TV and stares at the yellow-flowered curtains drawn tightly closed. She remembers the recitation, the dress she borrowed from her cousin, white like a bride's, with a plain scooped collar and full skirt, and the flickering candles, and the solemn, weighted feeling of her feet as she approached the altar, step by step, stopping before she reached the red carpet, which girls were not allowed to touch. Outside, it was a brilliant May day. Inside, the church was blurred and dim with shadow. The faces in the congregation were like faces she had never seen before, and even now she remembers it. The wonderful feeling of knowing no one, and no one knowing you, the wide open space of all that.
"Now it's been 5 minutes," Mary Margaret says.
Salome leads her to the sink and bends her head beneath the faucet. Mary Margaret's neck is tender as a bird's beneath Salome's thick hand.
"Ow!"
ow, it hurts my back, Mary Margaret says. Wash it out, hurry. Salome adjusts the water temperature and rinses Mary Margaret's hair the way she did when she was a child, and Mary Margaret was always younger, always more helpless, always more frail. Your sister isn't strong, Mama told her again and again. Versprich mir. Promise you'll take care of your sister. Salome coaxed Mary Margaret to eat and helped her with chores. She rinsed her hair with chamomile and wrapped it up in rags so she would have curls for Mass each Sunday. She sewed Mary Margaret's wedding dress and assisted Mama at the birth of Mary Margaret's children. All her life, Salome has kept her promise. Versprich mir. I'll put in some of that blue rinse you like, Salome murmurs. Here, I'm almost done. But the psalm is singing inside her. She can remember every word spread out before her, clear as on any printed page, and feel the suck of her breath, the cold stare of the congregation. Let not the water flood overflow me, neither let the deep swallow me up, and let not the pit shut her mouth upon me. She finishes the blue rinse and wraps a towel around Mary Margaret's head, helps her to stand straight. I'm dizzy, Mary Margaret says. I think I'm going to faint. Salome guides her back to the chair and begins to towel the thin mat of pale blue curls, taking half breaths to avoid the ammonia smell. Now, ain't this nice? She says, making her voice penny bright. I believe this is the nicest one yet. You got curls like a schönes Mädchen. But Mary Margaret will not be comforted. There are times I still miss Mama, she says, and she twists her mother's ring round and round on her finger. Oh, don't you miss Mama sometimes? The hands toweling Mary Margaret's hair freeze for a brittle moment. Salome keeps no yellow flowers in her own lonely kitchen. She has emptied her mind of everything but God, who does not let a sparrow fall from the sky unnoticed, who mourns a cowboy who looked just like the rest, who will certainly remember Salome on the day of judgment and welcome her home. Reproach hath broken my heart, and I am full of heaviness, and I looked for some to take pity, but there was none, and for comforters, but I found none. Hold still, Salome says. Ellen comes through the front door with a crash, carrying two grocery bags and clutching a jug of milk. Amy trails behind with a box of laundry soap. She holds the door for Herbert, who is dreamily swinging a loaf of bread. All of them pause when they see Mary Margaret. She sits in her chair beside the window, crowned by a halo of wisp blue curls. Salome is bundled up in a tattered coat, her big black purse hanging from her shoulder. Auntie Salome, Ellen says, looking studiously away from Mary Margaret. The room smells of ammonia. If you give me a minute to unload these groceries, I'll take you home.
Powdered milk is cheaper,
Mary Margaret says, looking at the milk jug. Her eyes are red behind her bifocals, and the veins in her forehead stand out in a pattern that reminds Ellen of stained glass.
How come you took so long?
Ellen shrugs. She's been at her mother's, but she does not tell Mary Margaret this, and neither do the kids. When James is traveling, Ellen has to borrow Fritz and Mary Margaret's car, and they complain whenever she uses it for something more than the usual household errands. Everything else is frivolous.
Wasting gas. Money doesn't grow on trees.
It stinks in here, Amy says. Beauty has its price, Ellen says, and she herds them quickly into the kitchen, leaving her coat on. She is busy putting away the perishables when she feels Salome's finger against her neck. She jumps. Salome has always made her nervous, the way she moves, silent as a cat, the way she will stare directly at you, saying nothing.
Senile old bat, Fritz calls her,
and Mary Margaret does not object. Ellen tries not to look at her ankles, which have swollen over the edges of her sneakers. She wonders how Salome manages to walk all the way from her apartment downtown, which she does faithfully every other month to give Mary Margaret her permanent wave.
I don't need the ride, Salome murmurs. I wouldn't trouble you.
No, really, it's no trouble, Ellen searches for a lie. I have another errand to run. She closes the refrigerator to find Salome emptying out the remaining grocery bag. She uses two hands to lower each can unsteadily to the counter.
"Oh, you don't have to do that," Ellen says.
A can slips away, thumps to the floor just inches from Bert's foot. He picks it up, studies it carefully.
"Green beans," he says. "Mom, look, I can read it."
Amy says, "You didn't read it, you just looked at the picture."
"Green beans," Ellen says, watching Salome.
"Read this word," Amy tells Bert, grabbing the can. "This word, right here." Salome is putting cans of peas and kidney beans into the sink. She opens the oven door, loads the racks with fruit cocktail, tomato paste, rolls of toilet tissue. She sniffs the bars of ivory and slips them into the silverware drawer.
"Beans!" Herbert shouts.
"How quickly this goes with someone to help me," Ellen says to Salome, grateful that the kids haven't noticed. Salome's heavy face is perspiring, and Ellen sees that she has been paid for the extra trip downtown. For years, Salome worked as a domestic, keeping house for a doctor in Whitefish Bay. Now she lives by herself on Social Security, with no family left except Mary Margaret. Ellen realizes she must be lonely, and she makes up her mind to stop over for a visit now and then on her evening walks. Odd Auntie Salome, Mary Margaret's sister. It's hard to imagine either of them as children, wide-eyed and sturdy, bending over some game with their heads nearly touching, the way Amy and Herbert do. But perhaps that's what Ellen needs most. Glimpses of Mary Margaret as a child, a sister, a teenage girl, a young woman with two children and a husband already angry, distant, beginning to stoop from seasons of hard work. There must be a way to pass through Mary Margaret's bitter cloud and grasp hold, a clumsy embrace, if only for a moment.
"Thank you for your help," she tells Salome.
"You are welcome."
Salome's stern voice is a warning. The collar of her house dress flops loose like the ear of a dog that has been in a fight. Ellen wonders what to talk about on the drive back to Salome's apartment. The children, maybe? Cutting hair? The science project Ellen is helping her class set up at school? She folds up the empty grocery bags and tucks them under the sink. What she wants is a real conversation, one adult to another, and it occurs to her that she is the one who is lonely. The days end and begin again without a seam, a wrinkle, a welcome dropped stitch. She keeps the house, shops, cooks, goes to work, takes care of the children, reasons with Mary Margaret and Fritz, worries over James's increasingly silent moods. There's no time left over for renewing high school friendships or chatting with the other teachers in the lounge after school. Sometimes she phones her sisters on weekends, and it's good to laugh with them for a while, but when she tries to explain how she's feeling, they simply assure her that things will get better. And perhaps they're right, after all. They're older, they've been married longer, they've lived through their own empty times. Certainly women like Salome have survived worse, caring for families that are not her own, raising children they'll never see again, all for minimum wage and perhaps a small bonus for the holidays. Outside, Ellen hovers next to Salome as they cross the icy driveway to the car, wanting to hold her elbow but knowing it would only hurt Salome's fierce pride. Today at her mother's, she helped clean the pantry from the floor to the very top shelves. Mom noticed how quickly Ellen climbed the ladder.
"You think I'm too old to climb up there?" she said.
She is 72.
"Get down from there," she said.
And for the rest of the afternoon, she played the acrobat while Ellen cleaned the cupboards down below. This had always been the chore of the youngest child, the one not yet trusted with heights, still forbidden to touch the china cups peering down from the top shelf. The pantry was a small, windowless room off the kitchen, cool in summer, warm in winter, smelling of vanilla and soft cooking lard, a favorite place to hide with a doll or a diary. A child crouched on the floor could imagine herself in a secret passage, each irregular cupboard a false door, an intriguing deception filled with possibility. There was sugar to lick from the tip of a wet finger pecked into the bin behind the door. There were dried apples, prunes, sour-skinned pears. Sometimes there was a bundt cake, untouchable yellow moon, or a tall, white-frosted angel food gleaming from the top shelf like a star. Once, during a summer visit home from Illinois, Amy disappeared for almost an hour. Ellen and James searched the house, the barn, the chicken coop,
They called out into the fields, double-checked the wooden seal in the old well. "Where could that child have slipped to?" Mom said, coming up from checking the cold cellar and hearing the old phrase, "slipped to." Ellen suddenly knew. There in the pantry, tucked into the same narrow cupboard that had been Ellen's secret place, was Amy, fast asleep beside a burlap bag of cat chow. "James," Ellen hissed toward the kitchen, wanting someone else to confirm that this was a flesh-and-blood child and not a ghost, the shadow of her own childhood self preserved by a trick of light, a modern-day miracle. Sneaking glances at Salome, Ellen wonders what ghosts have been left behind in the house she and Mary Margaret grew up in, the only daughters in a family made up of 6 brothers, a father known for his skill at farming, a mother who had once taught school. Sometimes Mary Margaret speaks of her mother with such longing that it's hard to believe she's been dead since James was small. Yet Ellen has never heard Salome talk about anything more personal than the weather, the homily at last Sunday's Mass, her sister's fresh curled hair. They arrive safely at the car and Ellen gets in, relieved. She starts to put on her seatbelt, but Salome shakes her head, fixing her gaze on Ellen, who realizes, shocked, that Salome's eyes are a beautiful marbled blue, like the pictures of the world in the children's science books.
"If it is your time to die," Salome says solemnly, "these things here won't help you."
Ellen's hand automatically releases the seatbelt. This is something her mother might say. Out at the farm this afternoon, she noticed a crisp blue sticker pressed to the old Frigidaire. "God is my pilot." "Then where are you, Mom?" Ellen thought to herself as she wrestled the children out of their coats, trying not to imagine the empty cockpit, the long plummet down to earth. No matter how hard she might try to believe, doubt would tear her from the sky in a fiery scream. The thought felt hollow in the pit of her stomach. How could she even think that she didn't trust God? Perhaps this was a test of her faith. Perhaps this was the same sort of temptation the saints felt so long ago. An odd thought that quickly took root, burning with poisonous flowers.
"Where'd you get that sticker?"
Ellen asked her mother, piling the coats on the radiator.
"I wanted it at bingo."
Mom kissed the children hello, and they clung to her possessively until she thumped into a hard-backed kitchen chair, pulling them along into her lap, a gesture as fluid, as easy as breathing.
"My snickle britches,"
she told them over their chatter, and when Ellen looked back at the sticker, it suddenly seemed reasonable. Only God knew what was in store for her. Only God could make decisions based on all the facts. Yet lately, God seemed so far removed. While the children were playing out in the barn, she had tried once more to explain to Mom about James, how badly things had been going. "I don't know what to do," she told her, flushing, because even as she was speaking, she knew she would wish she had not. "I work full-time, plus take care of the kids and his parents, too, but when I ask him to help me, he won't."
"If you'd quit your job, you wouldn't need to ask for help, and you'd have more time to spend with him. It's not like you need the money to pay rent."
Mom had never approved of Ellen working after the children were born.
"But he doesn't want to spend time with me.
The other night I suggested we go out to dinner, just the two of us, and he said, 'Money doesn't grow on trees.' That's exactly what he says to the kids when they ask for something. It's as if he doesn't see me anymore, Mom. It's like I'm invisible." Mom got increasingly busy polishing the flower canisters. She restacked the cups and saucers. She worked a stray toothpick from between the shelf and the wall.
"Are you doing your wifely duty?" she said.
It took a minute for Ellen to realize what she meant. It had been almost a year since James had been interested in wifely duties of any kind. Once she slipped naked into bed beside him, nuzzled her chin against his neck.
"I'm too tired for this foolishness," he had said in a voice he used with the children whenever they made too much noise.
It was hard to approach him after that. In fact, her body did seem foolish to her. Doughy lumps for breasts, dark raisin navel. A cookie doll the children might make at school, decorate with sweet sprinkles and crumble into their mouths. "He's not willing,"
Ellen said. She was lining the cupboards with fresh paper, and her voice sounded hollow, caught deep in the wooden bins.
"Lose some weight," Mom said gruffly, "or gain some. Find out what he likes."
And Ellen had agreed, wanting so much to be close to her mother the way her older, more traditional sisters were. The advice she got from them was the same. Disguise yourself. Don't say what you feel. This was the key to a happy marriage, the key to a strong faith in God. Driving home, she had stared out across the empty fields. Clouds formed a low, drifting ceiling above them, gray and white and darker gray. The distant farmhouses were also gray, the occasional sunflower shape of a windmill sprouting beside them. She passed a weathered barn, a herd of black and white Holsteins exhaling somber, smoky puffs. Frost heaves slashed dark lines across the road, some so neatly parallel that they looked like painted cattle guards. But Ellen drove across them without flinching, watching for the clumps of pines that marked the boundaries of each field, hungry for that deep, dull green that seemed like a promise somehow, a wish, a prayer. Summers working in the fields with her sisters, picking stones, driving tractor, casting down each new fine web of seed, she would squint into the distance at the next cool clump of pines where they might break to rest and drink clear jars of sweetened water. They sang as they worked, their skirts knotted high between their legs, moving from north to south so that the sun was never directly in their eyes, and the cows in the neighboring pastures moved with them, bells tolling like voices. There was no bitterness in her memories of these fields, the long hours spent inching over the land, the same life that James remembers with such distaste. His children will never put their hands into dirt. His children will never know sunburn, chilblains, the numbing repetition of the hoe. "I suppose you're right," she tells Salome as she leaves her seatbelt dangling loose at her side. Salome leans back in her seat, trusting and contented, one hand caressing her throat. But Ellen is distracted as she guides the car through the snowy streets, waiting for the patch of black ice, the speeding car, the drunken driver blaring his horn. Mary Margaret shoos the children away and lies down on the daybed. She twists Mama's ring round and round on her pinky finger. There's magic in this ring, she knows, even though Father Bork refuses to bless it, warning of superstition. But once, she stopped by the church at midday when she knew it would be empty. She dipped the ring into the holy water font and wore it on her finger as it dried. When she knelt to light a candle, the flame flared high, and Mary Margaret saw Mama's face as clearly as if she were standing there. There were no signs of torture in Mama's eyes. Her hair was unsinged, her lips moist and pink. Even though she knows Mama must be burning in hell, Mary Margaret takes comfort from that image. She gets up and goes to sit at the piano, places her fingers on the keys. Arthritis has stiffened her hands. They are bulbous, ugly. She does not recognize them. As a girl, she had the most beautiful hands. Winter nights, she rubbed them with butter to keep them supple and strong. In the warm summer months, she walked 3.5 miles into Holly's field to sit in the organ loft at St. Michael's, where she closed her eyes and played whatever her mind could hear, the world around her tumbling from her shoulders like a robe. The piano had been a gift from Mama the year after Salome left home for good, when Mary Margaret turned 15. Mama bought it used from a family in Cedarton, and though the pedals stuck, all the keys worked except for 3. Mornings after she finished helping in the kitchen, Mary Margaret carried her little gray cat into the living room, settled her warmly into her lap, and played the piano until it was time to fetch dinner to her father and older brothers in the field. She hated reading music and memorized things quickly. The notes looked ugly and hard, like goat droppings. Nothing Mary Margaret saw on the page looked anything like the way the music really felt. When she played, she saw past the ragged landscapes that were the lives of her mother and sister and the neighboring women. She peered into a world of color and sound, of finishing schools and glorious cathedrals, a world where Mama promised her that one day she would go. She would not be the wife of a farmer, bound to his whims and the whims of God's seasons, the random disasters and strokes of good luck that brought children and drought, sickness, and the occasional windfall of cash from a bumper crop. She would not lose her teeth to childbirth, her eyesight to the summer sun's glare. She would not lose her music to a man's desire for land and sons. Now she plays a few minor chords, hums the beginning of a melody. But she has no ear for the music anymore. Her soul is wide and plain as a field of winter wheat. The Lord giveth and he taketh away. For many years, Fritz kept the piano stored in the barn, and by the time he allowed it into the house, Mama was dead and Mary Margaret's fingers had forgotten how to play beyond the simple notes, the movements of her fingers.
"Goddamn caterwauling cat in heat! Cat would make a better mother than you."
She has imagined Fritz's death many times. Sometimes at night, she lies awake, staring at him across the space between their beds, thinking of how it would be to fetch the straight razor from beside the bathroom sink, the scissors from Mama's old sewing basket. After Mama died, Mary Margaret chopped up a panful of iris leaves and simmered them on the wood stove until all that was left was a caramel-colored liquid. It would have been easy, then, to pour it into his coffee. It would be easy, even now, to cradle the razor in her hand, sweep it across his throat as if she were slicing the sour, thick skin of a rutabaga. Frightened, she slides her mother-of-pearl pillbox out of the pocket of her housecoat. Thinking about something can make it happen, which is why having such thoughts is a sin. She taps out two pills, swallows them dry, then closes her eyes. She is not brave the way Mama was brave. She cannot defy God's laws. When Mary Margaret dies, her unsoiled soul will go up to heaven, kept from Mama's soul forever. "Talk to me, Mary May," Father Bork says when he stops by on his monthly visit. He uses the name Mama used when he'd come to Mama's house for tea, and Mary Margaret, wearing her nicest dress, would carry it to him in a pink china cup. "Mary May, get Father his sugar. Mary May, tell Father your kitty cat's name." "There's been something troubling your mind for years. I'm your confessor, child. I'm here to help." But Mary Margaret never talks about Anne, although she sometimes cries and clutches Father Bork's hand. It embarrasses her to have him see her come to this. She wonders what he thinks when he looks at her now, an old woman weeping into a crumpled pink handkerchief. She wonders what James thinks, what Mitch thinks when he looks down from heaven. She does not let herself wonder about the other two, who are floating in limbo between the saved and the banished, unbaptized, without the slightest hope of rest, comfort, home. It was Pa who forced her to marry in 1932, the year she turned 24. "I ain't keeping no old maids," he said. Francis Greer was a hired man's son, the youngest of 14 children. He was known as a hard, strong worker, and when Pa offered him Mary Margaret, he said he'd agree if she came with 40 acres of good land. "We got ourselves a fellow knows what he wants," Pa told Mama. "Best kind of man you can find." It was the only time in her life that Mary Margaret saw her mother cry. She was married 2 months later, and after the brief wedding service, Mama slipped a prayer card into her hand. "Pray this tonight when you need to," she said. And during the long, silent ride in the wagon back to Fritz's shanty, Mary Margaret kept it pressed to her heart. When they arrived, she went into the tiny bedroom and put on the white lace nightgown Mama and Salome had made for her. "You do what he tells you," Mama had said. But when Fritz came in, his hands dark with wagon grease, he ripped the pretty gown from her chest to her knees. "I don't like none of that," he said. That night, she chanted Mama's prayer so deep inside herself that Fritz, no matter what he might do, couldn't truly find her. "Lord, help me to accept what I cannot change. Lord, help me to accept this." 3 weeks later, Pa was gored by a neighbor's bull, and before he died, he willed the farm and everything else he owned to Fritz. Fritz and Mary Margaret moved into the big stone farmhouse, and Fritz told Mama she could stay if she did not interfere. "You raised up a goddamn lady," he told her. "Now I gotta fix her for a wife." And Mama held back, though her face flushed when Mary Margaret appeared in the morning for breakfast with an eye swollen shut, an arm in a makeshift sling. Nights, Mary Margaret prayed silently as the hands moved over her body, forcing open her jaws, squeezing her breasts until she gasped, but, praise to God, she never made a sound that might have trickled through the walls to the narrow room where Mama slept. Sometimes, though, she was unable to hide her shame.
"Get out!"
he'd tell Mama, lifting Mary Margaret's skirts as she stood washing laundry in the galvanized tub. At times like that, he liked to look into Mama's face and see all the things there that she wished to do to him, but he thought dared not. Over the years, the color of Mama's hatred turned red as blood. Mary Margaret could see it like a haze around her head, but Fritz, like his sons, could not see color, could not understand what it might mean. When she opens her eyes, Jimmy's little girl is standing there, one foot stepping on the other. The pills Mary Margaret swallowed make her feel soft and warm, as though a hand were trailing down her spine. She sees herself at Amy's age, with lovely slim hands and hair in curls. Mama taught Salome how to make those curls by wrapping Mary Margaret's hair in bits of rags. Salome herself had stringy hair, no good for curling. Now Mary Margaret sees Salome in this girl's straight hair, in her close-together eyes and stubby lashes. She feels repulsed by this little girl, the way she always felt repulsed by Salome. The smell of Salome when they slept side by side in the tiny bed Pa made for them, the dribbling sound of her snores. Common Salome. Yet it was Salome the teachers admired. It was Salome who dreamed dreams that always came true, mystifying even Mama. But Mary Margaret was the beautiful one, the one who heard music and everything, the one who had made up her mind she would be different from Salome and her mother and any other woman she had ever known.
"Can we have some bread and butter if we eat at the counter?" Amy says.
"Such an ugly little girl."
Mary Margaret shakes her head and fingers her soft blue curls, not realizing she has spoken aloud.
Christmas. Ellen and James slept in the front bedroom, a small room carpeted in gold with gold curtains that hang in the windows as stiffly as paintings. The bed sprawls almost to the door with a thin brown dresser wedged against the wall. Above the bed hangs a crucifix draped with braided palm fronds saved from many years of Palm Sundays. The eyes of Christ appear half open. His spindly hands are clenched into fists. He stares across their bodies, his gaze falling on the coffee table at the foot of the bed, where a blue plaster statue of Mary opens her arms to embrace the air. James punches his pillow into the shape of a mushroom and lets his head fall into it, a sudden release like letting a suitcase drop. When Ellen touches his shoulder, he jumps. "Cold hands," he says. "Don't." He rolls over on his side, facing her, the sheets clutched up under his chin. "If you think they'll let you pay for a real tree when they've got a perfectly good free one in the basement," he says, "you don't know them at all."
"Would you eat an artificial turkey at Thanksgiving?" she asks, trying to tease him.
"That's silly," he says, seriously. "People don't eat plastic."
"But there are advantages to an artificial tree. Pa's right. It won't wilt. It won't drop needles or drip sap. It's not a fire hazard."
"It's not a Christmas tree, either."
"I remember when they bought it. Must have been 20 years ago. It was before anybody had heard of an artificial tree. Everyone came over to see it, and they pinched it and asked how much it cost. Artificial trees look real, Ellie. You can't tell the difference."
"Well, they don't smell real."
"Well, we can get some spray, some room fresher, whatever you call it."
He relaxes a little, the sheet pulling away his bare chest, smooth and hairless as a child's.
"Everybody came to see it," he says. "Mother had me and Mitch serve them store cookies. The next year, they all got artificial trees, but we had the first one."
He strokes Ellen's foot absentmindedly with his, and she knows he is thinking of that plastic tree, the one his neighbors and relatives admired so long ago. He wants to be a teenaged boy again, trailing behind his mother with a plate of cookies, not common homemade cookies, but cookies bought at a store.
"Offer them a cookie, Jimmy."
The old people in town still talk about what a sweet boy he was, so unlike his brother, so unlike his father. Mama's boy.
But how long has that tree been down there? Ellen asks.
It's an artificial tree, Ellen. It's not like it's going to rot or anything. A live Christmas tree that's just going to die anyway costs $10. We don't have the money that we can buy every kind of thing we want.
His foot against hers is frenzied. Abruptly, he pulls it away. This isn't about money, she says.
But she knows from the angry flutter of his eyelids that this is the end of the discussion.
She turns out the light and stares up at the dark ceiling. It gradually becomes visible, the white spackling pale and irregular as the surface of the moon. Tomorrow is Christmas Eve. Tonight, Fritz finally agreed to let them put up the tree, provided there be no hassle, no commotion.
I've seen enough of this nonsense to last me a lifetime, he told James. Just 'cause you still got the appetite for it don't mean I should suffer, too.
And James seemed to grow smaller, his shoulders lifting with each careful breath like someone who has been crying for a long time.
Don't worry, Pa, he said. We won't bother you.
Thinking of this, Ellen moves closer to James, pressing her forehead against the cool, damp skin of his upper arm. He doesn't pull away, but he doesn't respond. It's as if she's falling asleep in a room of her own, something she's never done. She slept with her mother from the time her father died until she left home for school at 17. Even now, when she wakes up in the night, she sometimes thinks she's back in Mom's room, with a dog lying between them and the cats braided together at the foot of the bed. In winter, frost angels played on the window panes. In summer, Mom left the window open wide so the scent from the mock orange trees seeped into the sheets. During the night, neither awake nor asleep, Ellen would reach out with her foot to touch Mom's leg, which was always there, solid and serene. And Mom, without waking, would turn toward Ellen and pat her face with her warm, rough hand. Mornings after Mom got up, there were always sisters' beds to climb into, damp and warm and slightly sweet from the soap they used in their hair.
Oh, Ellie, it's so early, they'd moan, folding her into their arms.
She'd doze for an extra minute or two until Mom's voice rang up the stairwell.
Girls, you got breakfast and chores now. Don't make me come up there after you.
But whenever Ellen reaches out for James, he's ready with some excuse. He's ticklish. Her hands are too cold. He's tired. He wants to be left alone. She tries to remind herself that for James, being touched was often an act of anger, a slap, a shove, a beating. The artificial tree was a bright moment and all that.
Perhaps, Ellen thinks, I'm the one who's acting selfishly. I have so many good memories of my childhood. Who am I to deny him this? It might even draw all of us together in a way no live tree could. James and his parents can remember better times, and the children and I will become part of that memory.
It's okay about the tree, Ellen says before she realizes he is sleeping. He begins to snore, a light, musical sound that seems to come from somewhere far away. The next day, the children sit at the kitchen table, stringing popcorn and cranberries for the artificial tree. Ellen is busy stuffing the goose, one from her sister Miriam's flock that they're having for Christmas dinner. Amy cuts a star out of cardboard, paints it gold, sprinkles it with glitter. She's braided her hair clumsily with red and green ribbons. Bert, not to be outdone, knots a piece of ribbon into his own short hair. The decorations are laid out on the counter. Clothespin soldiers, yarn dolls, candy wrapped in tinfoil. Drying on a cookie sheet are stars made of salt and flour dough. The color of the dough is light gray, almost blue. Later they'll paint the stars red and gold, purple and green, even though Mary Margaret says there are no such things as purple and green stars. She sits in a chair by the kitchen window, a red flannel scarf wrapped around her neck, sucking on horehound candies. A granny square afghan covers her knees. Periodically, she sighs. Mary Margaret's always catching a cold, but Ellen has never known her to have one. She doesn't want to help Ellen fix Christmas dinner. She doesn't want to make Christmas decorations. She doesn't want to watch the game with Fritz and James in the living room. Now and then she'll turn to comment on whatever it is Ellen is doing.
Mama always beat her eggs up two-handed, she says. Or, Mama checked her cakes with a knife, not a fork.
Mary Margaret's mother, Anne, has been dead for many years. Still, they are having Christmas dinner tonight on Christmas Eve because that's the way Anne did it. Mary Margaret gets up to part the curtains and peer out at the yard. Snow, she says, the way someone else might say death or grief. Perhaps she is remembering Christmas with her mother and father and brothers and sister, all of whom are dead except Salome. Salome is spending Christmas Eve at the rectory with the ladies of the Altar Society. The society sews the church linens, launders them, grows flowers for the altar, makes quilts for the missions, organizes bake sales, vacuums, and dusts the church once a month. For a slice of ham and a dollop of instant potatoes, Father Bork will buy another year of hard labor, Ellen thinks. But then she is ashamed. It is Christmas Eve. She apologizes silently as she ties the drumsticks of the goose together with thread, rubs the skin with margarine.
"It's too early to put in that goose," Mary Margaret says, sniffing.
"Do you think so?" Ellen says, keeping her voice level as she sticks it in the oven. She's known how to cook a goose since she was 10, and her mother slipped in the barn, breaking both her wrists. It was the day before Thanksgiving, and the next day, Ellen and Julia and Heidi cooked the meal as Mom directed them from her chair, her wrists held in place by heavy splints.
"Mama made goose so it would fall off the bone."
"How many geese did you keep?" Ellen asks to distract her.
"Oh, 2-3 dozen. Nasty things. Mean. Ate up the lawn. In spring, you'd step off the porch into muck."
She sits back down and rocks, lost in thought, remembering the geese. Her chin nods to her chest, her hands clutch the afghan. Sometimes Ellen wants to make Mary Margaret understand that in so many ways they are the same, that their lives were decided for them by forces they did not recognize in time. But when Mary Margaret looks at Ellen, she sees her son's failure to marry well. When she sees Ellen's first child, she sees a girl who can give her nothing. She doesn't look up again until James comes into the kitchen, his cheeks flushed from watching the Packers. "Who's winning?" Ellen says, even though she really doesn't care.
"Not us," he says. "This looks very nice," he tells the kids.
Bert nods shyly. Amy shrugs. Ellen can feel how they are nervous, wondering what he wants, this strange man who is their father. But today he is trying. Ellen can see how hard he's trying in the way he stands, shifting foot to foot.
"Jimmy, that bird'll all be dried out if she puts it in now," Mary Margaret says.
"Smells good," James says, not looking at his mother. Ellen asks quickly, "When are you bringing up the tree?"
"Oh, soon," he says. "When you're done with this, I guess."
And he gestures vaguely at the ornaments, the twisted red and white ropes of cranberries and popcorn. "We're almost done," Ellen says. "I want to leave time for a nap after supper so we're all wide awake for midnight mass."
"What kind of tree is it?" Amy suddenly asks James.
"What?"
"You know, like, is it a fir or a scotch pine?"
James considers this.
"I guess you'll have to tell me when you see it," he says. "Maybe it's just a Christmas tree."
"Mama made goose so it fell off the bone," Mary Margaret says. "This goose will be dried right up."
"I think it'll be fine," James says softly. He kisses Ellen's cheek, surprising her, then heads back into the living room. Mary Margaret sulks, wrapping the red flannel scarf more tightly around her neck, but she doesn't say anything else. After James is gone, Amy rolls her eyes and says, "There's no such thing as a Christmas tree."
"Use your imagination," Ellen says.
But Amy rolls her eyes a second time. Lately, she's been studying James, looking for signs of weakness, for chances to prove him wrong. She's at an age where she is figuring out that her parents are not perfect. She resents it, resents them. But it is James whom she blames. It frightens Ellen sometimes to think of Amy as a 10-year-old girl, almost a teenager, certainly beginning to emerge as an individual person. She watches Amy work with the scissors, searching for clues that will tell her what Amy will be like when she's grown, 8 Christmases from now. She wonders what all of them will be like as she scours the countertop with bleach, thinking of James's unexpected kiss. During halftime, James goes into the basement. He's down there for a long time before they hear him curse. His voice travels up the heating vent and echoes in the living room as if he were right there. "God damn it," he says. The kids giggle and run downstairs. Mary Margaret giggles, too, sneaks looks at Ellen. Her boy is being naughty. She sits in her parlor chair by the window in her pink chenille robe, her hair freshly curled, rinsed the color of the faintest blue sky. Beside her, Fritz sprawls in his lazy boy. When Ellen moves the end table from between the chairs to make room for the tree, his sock feet stick straight up like exclamations. "Where the hell am I going to set my coffee?" he says. "How the hell can I see to read without the lamp?" "The Christmas tree will give off light," she says, "or I can set the lamp up somewhere else if you want." Balloons fill the TV screen. The crowd cheers. It is time for the halftime show. Amy and Herbert race back up from the basement, and Ellen hears the sound of metal being dragged across concrete, then the thump, rest, as James jerks the tree up the stairs. "God damn it!" "How's it look?" she asks the kids. Herbert says, "Big." Amy says, "Green." "Where the hell am I going to set my paper?" Fritz says, just as James and the tree burst out of the stairwell in an explosion of painted bark and plastic needles. The tree is a vivid neon green, strangled in wide ropes of gold and silver tinsel. Red glass balls glisten like wounds. The angel at the top is missing a wing, and one of her eyes is askew. "It's already decorated," Ellen says. "Let's work this way," James pants. "You just bring it up, no hassles." "Oh," she says. He jams it between Fritz and Mary Margaret's chairs in the space where the end table used to be. It is so tall that the angel is pushed flat against the ceiling. The smell of the basement fills the room, moist concrete mildew. "Some of the ornaments are broken," Amy says. "Look, there's a spider," Herbert says. "Yuck!" "There's another one," Amy says. "No problem," James says. "We'll just pick off the broken ornaments, and as for the spiders..." He disappears into the bathroom and comes back with the Lysol. "Pine-scented," it says, in bold letters across the side. "That's expensive," Mary Margaret says, but James opens fire on the tree. Spiders drop from the branches and scuttle across the moss-colored carpet. Amy and Herbert stomp most of them. "There," James says. His eyes water through the Lysol, and the angel's skewed eye seems to be watering, too. "I don't like this Christmas tree," Herbert says. "Come on now," James says, sounding playful but showing too many teeth. "Isn't this the best Christmas tree we've ever had?" It is the ugliest Christmas tree Ellen has ever seen. The tree forms a perfect triangle, and the metal trunk is painted a smooth artificial brown, the color of tree trunks in children's books. Real trees are lopsided, too fat in the middle, skinny on top. Real trees have bald spots, ragged trunks, rough edges. "How am I going to read my goddamn paper without the lamp? That's what I want to know," Fritz says. "For heaven's sake, I'll set up your lamp on the other side," Ellen says. "You forgot the cotton," Mary Margaret says. "The mice got into it," James says. "Pa, I'll set some traps down there if you want." "There's no mice in that basement," Fritz says. "There's no goddamn mice any place in this house."
"What's the cotton for?" Ellen asks.
James gives her a funny look. "Snow," he says. "You know, you put the cotton under the tree so it looks like snow, and then you set the presents on it."
"Pa, it's crawling with mice down there. Why don't you let me set some traps?"
Fritz stands up, hoist his pants. James's face goes gray.
"Come on, Pa," James says softly. I don't mean nothing by it."
"We don't need to have snow," Ellen says, trying to smooth things over. But Fritz is suddenly angry.
"What?" he says.
He snaps off the TV.
"It ain't good enough for you, Jimmy. It ain't good enough for you here."
"Pa, I didn't mean that."
"You think you can do better, you are welcome to leave right now and take the rest of them with you and all their goddamn commotion. Bringing up this nonsense," he says, and he's yelling now, waving his arm at the tree. "All this bullcrap. Let me tell you something. This ain't no goddamn slum. There's no goddamn mice in the goddamn basement. Do you understand?"
He grabs James by the collar and punches him in the face. Blood spurts from James's nose. He backs away, his head bent to his chest, making no move to defend himself. Fritz hits him again. The blow glances off James's shoulder. Fritz kicks him in the shins before he turns away, breathing heavily. It has happened so quickly that it doesn't seem real, but then James licks blood from the top of his lip, and Ellen hurts for him. She is burning with a clean, hot rage. She approaches Fritz from behind, not knowing what she will do, but James looks up and sees her. Then she feels how she is shaking all over.
Get the kids' coats, he tells her thickly.
No, Jimmy,
Mary Margaret says, but James is pushing the kids through the room and into the entryway. Ellen follows with her coats, still trembling, hearing the crash and tinkle of the tree being thrown to the ground. Fritz grunting with the effort. James shoves them all roughly out the front door. The sudden cold air hurts Ellen's head. What about your mother? She says to James.
Pa won't bother her, James snaps.
He wipes his mouth and chin with a tissue, fumbles the keys from the pocket of his coat. All those years, it was always me and Mitch who took the brunt of it. The kids stare straight ahead. Snow is still falling, and the smell of the lake is in the air. Fish, sewage, cold green water. James unlocks his door, gets in, leans over to unlock Ellen's. She reaches around to unlock the back door. The sound of the locks is sharp as breaking ice. She wonders where they will go. To her mother? Maybe Julia? But even as she worries, she is exhilarated. They can't go on living with Fritz and Mary Margaret after this. She realizes she's been holding her breath, and she exhales slowly, cautiously. Get in and buckle up, she tells the kids. And then she gets in, too. She looks at James, his swelling nose, blood crusted around his mouth. Oh, honey, she whispers, do you want me to drive? He starts the car, squeals them out of the driveway.
Don't talk to me,
he says fiercely.
Don't you say one goddamn word.
They drive for miles and miles up to Cedarton over to Shulesville, following Highway KW along the lake. By now it is dark. The windows of the houses they pass are lit with holiday candles. Lights twinkle in the trees. Even with the heater on, it's cold, and Ellen wishes the kids had their boots. Odd thoughts flicker through her mind. The road construction that was here in fall. A green print dress she once tried to make for Amy. The position of her feet, crossed neatly at the ankles. She thinks about the chewing gum she has in her purse, longing for a piece, but not wanting to disturb the uneasy quiet. Snow spins in the glow of the headlights, and she remembers the blizzard of 59 that decided her life so quickly. James was driving her home when a storm set in, terrible and white. They pulled over, not sure if they were still on the road. All night they talked as they huddled beneath an old wool blanket, running the engine every half hour for heat. And in the morning, when the sky blew abruptly, brilliantly clear, and they heard the plow in the distance, they knew they would have to be married. For who would believe that a man and a woman could spend a night together in a car without making love? If they didn't marry, they both knew what the consequences would be, regardless of whether or not a baby came 9 months later. To choose to marry was far better than to have your parents choose for you, to be taken to the church by your tight-lipped families, to listen to people say for the rest of your lives. Them two, they had to tie the knot. I have to go to the bathroom, Amy says, and wordlessly James veers back toward town. They pull over at a family restaurant just south of Holly's Field. The broad front windows are like a stage, and Ellen stares greedily into other people's lives. The teenage couple sharing fries and pop. The group of women piling their coats cozily over a chair, arranging their purses and shopping bags around themselves in a way that makes her think of robins building nests. The old man stirring his coffee, licking a finger, a flick of gray tongue. She fights a sudden horrible urge to run. You coming in? She says to James, but he doesn't answer. His face is swollen and homely, and she knows that, once again, anything she says will be wrong. We'll just be a minute, she says. And then she takes the kids inside. The smell of frying burgers hits her stomach like a fist. I'm hungry, Herbert says. She leads him and Amy through the restaurant to the back where the restrooms are. She thinks about the goose she is cooking in the oven, ready to come out in half an hour. The dressing, the twice-baked potatoes waiting in the fridge, the kuchen. I don't have any money, she says. Besides, you'll spoil your dinner. Daddy has money. Daddy feels really bad right now. It's probably best not to bother him or ask him for anything because that will make him feel worse. The way we can make him feel better is to just stay very quiet. Bert's hair is still knotted with ribbon. She twists it free, then puts him in a stall to pee. Amy takes the stall farthest away from them. The restroom smells of toilet cleaner and strong musk perfume. He's going to leave us here, Amy says. Ellen can see her small feet swinging. What? He won't be there when we go back out. She speaks slowly and clearly as if she were speaking to a very small child. Of course he will, Ellen says. She takes Herbert to the sink, washes her hands, helps him reach the faucet. She hadn't thought of that. James leaving them here, traveling on, anywhere, far away. What she had wanted to do a moment earlier, but didn't. Herbert lets his hands drift dreamily under the water. Hurry, she tells him. Let's not keep Daddy waiting. He won't be there, Amy says again, smugly. She comes out of her stall and sticks her hands defiantly in her pockets. Stop it, Ellen says, hating her. You're being silly. Now wash your hands. Amy moves her hands through the water slowly, extra slowly, as Ellen's stomach falls and falls inside her. When they get back outside, the car is where they left it, idling hard, exhaust curling through the air. It is dark when they turn back onto Vinegar Hill. Herbert is sleeping. Amy shakes him awake as they pull into the driveway. The snow is heavier now, wet, crunching an inch deep beneath the wheels. The house is dark. Ellen starts to get out of the car, but James doesn't move. The engine idles uncertainly. Aren't you coming in? She says. I'm going out for a bit. I don't want to go in there alone. James stares straight ahead. Amy opens her door and gets out. Herbert gets out, too. Finally, Ellen gets out. So you'll be back for Mass? She says through the open door. Yes, damn it, he says. Yes, I'll be back. Well, where are you going? She says. But he pulls away, tires squalling on the ice. Wait, she shouts. I don't have the key. And she chases him out into the street. He tosses it past her without looking, drives away. She picks it up. It's hooked to a keychain in the shape of a smiling face. The kids are watching. She's horribly embarrassed. Then she is numb. Come on, she says briskly. Let's get inside before we freeze. He's not coming back ever, Amy says. Ellen pretends not to hear. When she snaps on the living room light, Mary Margaret blinks at them, owl-like, from her rose-embroidered chair. The Christmas tree is gone, the table back in place. Where's Jimmy? She says. Out, Ellen says, hanging up her coat, helping the kids with theirs. She can smell the goose and Lysol. He'll be back for midnight Mass. Fritz went for dinner at Senior Citizens, Mary Margaret says. They're having ham and scallop potatoes. I saw it announced in the paper, but I wanted to wait for Jimmy. Did you take the goose out? Ellen says. Mary Margaret shakes her head. Her lip curls faintly, pleased. The kids follow Ellen into the kitchen, hugging the walls. The popcorn, the walnuts, the strings of cranberries, everything is gone. The counter is a wide, white, gleaming space. They look at each other and their faces close up. Ellen sees they are going to pretend this hasn't happened, that nothing is wrong, and she is relieved to pretend that too.